Today's lesson is about the return to Jerusalem. In this class, we're studying the last days of Jesus' ministry. As he came back to Jerusalem, having already told his disciples that he was going to be killed and mistreated and killed and then buried and resurrected, they still didn't understand exactly what that meant. And it was the part about the resurrection, we talked about that in the last couple of weeks as we've been discussing the reality of resurrection and how he demonstrated to them in Lazarus' resurrection what that meant. It had other implications, of course, and it affected a lot of people who had come to the funeral and realized the power that Jesus had to raise the dead. So a lot of people put their faith in him. And we're going to look at a little bit of where we were last week before we move on. And let's see, we have... Yeah, that works. After raising Lazarus from the dead, the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin, and this is in the 11th chapter. We were there last week as we finished. They were concerned about the power of Jesus raising the dead, how it affected so many people, and they didn't understand what that meant, of course. What are we accomplishing, they asked. Here is this man performing many miraculous signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And then the Romans will come and take away both our place. That word, you'll notice in your NIV, has a footnote to it, referring it to the temple. Possibly that's what he means here. The Romans will take away our temple and our nation. And then one of them named Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. And that's kind of an interesting thing that Josephus explains to us. That Annas was the high priest. But he had been displaced by the Romans because of some difficulties they had. And in his place, three sons-in-law who the Romans appointed to the position, and they rotated that year by year. So it was kind of difficult to anticipate who was going to be high priest because it kept changing every year. But Caiaphas was the high priest when Jesus was arrested, and so Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, spoke up, "You know nothing at all. You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than for the whole and that the whole nation, or that than that the whole nation perish." And of course, that was true, wasn't it? And so John goes on to explain, he did not say this on his own, but as high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation. Not only for that nation, but also for the scattered children of God, to bring them together and to make them one. The scattered children of God, of course, included the Gentiles, ultimately. So from that day on, they plotted to take his life. The Sanhedrin did. Did everybody in the Sanhedrin agree to that conclusion? We'll take his life? In other words, you get that impression that they were all in favor of that, but we find that's not the case. Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus apparently did not agree with that. And so there were those objectors in the group. It's kind of hard to get a unanimous conclusion to his proposals, isn't it? Therefore, Jesus no longer moved about publicly, and I want to emphasize this last little paragraph here. He didn't move about publicly among the Jews. Instead, he withdrew to a region near the desert to a village called Ephraim, where he stayed with his disciples. Ephraim's about 10 miles away on the edge of the desert. Jerusalem's in the mountains. And that has, John's the only one who mentions this, and that has an important possibility when we look at some things that happen later on in the week. So keep in mind the fact that, Jesus is in Ephraim, and then in the 12th chapter, it starts out 6 days before the Passover, Jesus arrived in Bethany. So he had been there, you see, and then raised Lazarus, then gone back to Ephraim, and then 6 days before the Passover. Now, when is the Passover? We're going to try to figure that out. And so I want you to be thinking about that aspect of it. There's some ambiguity in it, and we're going to have to try to straighten that part out. So he comes back to Bethany, where Lazarus lived, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. Here a dinner was given in Jesus' honor. Well, it says here a dinner was given in Jesus' honor. It doesn't say 6 days before the Passover the dinner was given. And in fact, if you go look at Matthew and Mark, you find it was 2 days before the Passover when they had that dinner. And so I think John put it before the royal entrance, as we're going to call it, to kind of match it up with Lazarus, the raising of Lazarus. After all, he's the only one that talks about the raising of Lazarus as well. And so there's this dinner that was given. But it was probably given. Now, we're going to talk about, I'm going to place the Passover on Thursday. And so we'll see about that later on. But 6 days before then would have been when? Friday night, wouldn't it? When the dinner was given. Wouldn't have been given on a Sabbath, would it? Why? Don't give dinners on the Sabbath, do you? That's too much work. And so the dinner was probably on Friday. Actually, Thursday evening, when the Friday starts. And we've got to keep track of that as well, and we'll talk about that at the end of the class. Their days began at sunset, and there's a reason for that, and we'll discuss that too in a little bit. And so the day went from sundown to the next sundown, and so we're talking about a dinner Friday night. Martha served. Does that remind you of anybody? That reminds you of when Jesus visited in the house of Mary and Martha, and what did Martha do? She's a servant. She's the server, isn't she? She's the active one. And what did Mary do? Sat at the feet of Jesus. She's the better student, I suppose we would say. And so Martha served while Lazarus was among those reclining at the table with him. Who's him? That's Jesus, isn't it? Was given in honor of Jesus. Then Mary took about a pint of pure nard. That's spikenard as a term involving the perfume. And it's a very expensive perfume. She poured it on Jesus' feet and wiped his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. Now it also says in Matthew and Mark in the parallel passages, she put it on his head as well. But one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected, "Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It's worth a year's wages." What's a year's wages in our society? Even among the poor, now, how much is, we're talking about supplementing people's income. And so what would a year's wages be in our society? Average. We're talking about something $25,000 or $30,000 or $40,000, aren't we? Rich people make more than that. Poor people make less than that. But if she was, and so they're not they're not poor people. Keep that in mind. And so she had this perfume. Maybe it had been set aside. Maybe it was something handed down from her parents. We don't know. They were bottled up in a... The bottles for these perfumes were kind of interesting. Some of them were carved out of rock, certain kind of rock. I'm not sure they had... I don't think they had anything we would say was a glass bottle. But anyway, it was worth a year's wages. He did not say this because Judas cared about the poor. Why? Well, he was a thief, and his keeper of the money, he liked to dip into the till from time to time, and it would have been neat to have all that money in his bag. They really didn't have a whole lot of money in the bag as they went through the ministry of Jesus, did they? So he tended to help himself. Jesus' response was, leave her alone. It was meant that she should save this perfume for the day of my burial. Well, why didn't she just wait until he died? Of course, she didn't know exactly what was going to happen or if she would have access to him at that point, did she? And I don't think she's jumping the gun here particularly, as we say. I think she was taking it. This thing is really... Maybe I should move it down. Crying out on us here some, isn't it? I think she was really taking advantage of the opportunity that she had. You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me. And then added in Matthew and Mark's account was another statement that he made, and all of this is pretty much verbatim in all three accounts. It's left out of John's account, but included in the others. I tell you the truth, wherever this gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her, and that's in Matthew 26 and 13. And so that would be neat to have something connected with the life and teachings of Jesus, that whenever that story was told, she was remembered. Is it still true? Still true. Still fulfilled today in your hearing, isn't it? Yeah. So, meanwhile, a large crowd of Jews found out that Jesus was there. Now, nobody had told them. Remember, he's not moving about publicly, and this event wasn't publicized, but someone told them. And they came not only because of him, but they wanted to see Lazarus, didn't they? Whom he had raised from the dead. Would you want to see Lazarus if you were in that situation? Did this really happen? And there he is. And yeah, that's Lazarus. Now, I'm sure they oohed and aahed over the situation. So the chief priests made plans to kill Lazarus as well. Isn't that interesting that they went to that extreme? They're going to add anybody that's on... or anybody that makes a statement like Lazarus did by raising from the dead, they're going to add him to the group and kill him as well. For on account of him, many of the Jews were going over to Jesus and putting their faith in him. So you can see the dilemma that Jesus had. And so this was one of the reasons we think that this story was written with all the details only in John's gospel, because Lazarus was still alive when Matthew, Mark, and Luke were written, and it put Lazarus at risk to advertise it. All right. Now Mark, we'll switch over and go from John over to Mark 11. You could read any of these accounts. They're all pretty much alike. And in fact, what happens next is included in all four Gospels. And as they approached Jerusalem and came to Bethphage and Bethany at the Mount of Olives, Jesus sent two of his disciples saying to them, go to the village ahead of you, and just as you enter it, you will find a colt tied there, which no one has ever ridden. untie it and bring it here. If anyone asks you, why are you doing this, tell him the Lord needs it and we'll send it back here shortly. Mark's the only one that adds that last phrase. We'll give you the colt back. What's the risk of riding on a colt that has never been ridden before? Any of you ever ride a horse or a donkey that had never been ridden before? Who's the person that first rides those animals? You need somebody who knows what they're doing, first of all. And what? What do we call that when you ride an unridden? Breaking the horse or breaking the colt. And so there's some risk there, isn't there? Well, how can Jesus do that? How is Jesus a cowboy? Is he knowledgeable about these animals? Does he know what he's doing? Does he know the risk he's taking? And why did the animal submit to that? Do you ever think about that? Why would an animal submit to Jesus riding upon it and it had never been ridden before? Some rapport between Jesus and the animals, do you suppose? Okay, I suspect that's the case. Now, Matthew also says bring both the donkey and the colt, the mother of it, I guess. And so it took two animals. In this case, this account, he just talks about the colt. Well, they went and found a colt outside in the street, tied to a doorway. And as they untied it, some people standing there asked, "What are you doing untying that colt?" They answered as Jesus had told them to, and the people let them go. Some have supposed, and I think some commentaries say that maybe Jesus had made this arrangement earlier. He had certainly been there in Jerusalem many times, and maybe he had told somebody to tie the colt outside and we'll come pick it up. No indication of that, though, in the account. Burton Kaufman thought that was a possibility. But they were willing when they said, "The Lord needs it." Suppose the people who owned the colt knew who that was? Apparently so, didn't they? And so they let him have it, and the people let them go. When they brought the colt to Jesus, threw their cloaks over it, he sat on it. No indication of any difficulty there, is there? Many people spread their cloaks on the road, while others spread branches they had cut in the fields, and those who went ahead and those who followed shouted, "Hosanna." What does the word Hosanna mean? We would translate it in English as salvation. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Blessed is the coming kingdom of our father David. Hosanna in the highest. Do these people understand who this person is? Who are these people shouting this? Followers of Jesus? It looks as though they understand something that's going on and they're taking part in it and they're doing something that was prophesied, aren't they? We'll look at that in a moment. And so Jesus entered Jerusalem, went to the temple. He looked around at everything, but since it was already late, he went out to Bethany with the 12. So he went through the gate of the city and went to the temple. There are a lot of possibilities here as to what route he took, but it's thought that the king always entered. There was a gate, I guess it was called the King's Gate, on the east side where he would have entered. And so they're pretty sure they know where this would have taken place. And what about what the people said? Now, you've got some footnotes in your Bible, and the apostles didn't really understand what this was all about until later on. But if you go to Zechariah 9, verse 9, it says, "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, daughter of Jerusalem. See, your king comes to you, righteous and having salvation, gentle and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. Isn't that remarkable? Did Jesus do that deliberately to fulfill this particular prophecy? Could be, couldn't it? He knew what had been prophesied. He knew what the entrance should be. And what about riding on a donkey? How did what kind of animals did the kings ride on? They rode what? Yeah, David's son and others, they didn't ride on a donkey. What did they ride on? They rode on a mule. Remember that? A big animal, didn't they? And yet Jesus rode on a young donkey. What does that suggest? Humility? Righteous and having salvation. And how did they know to shout Hosanna? There's another psalm that I thought was interesting. It isn't one that's footnoted in the NIV, but I think it applies to the occasion, doesn't it? Lift up your heads, O ye gates, Psalm 24. Be lifted up, you ancient doors, and the King of glory may come in. Who is this King of glory? The Lord, strong and mighty, the Lord mighty in battle. Lift up your heads, O ye gates, lift them up, ye ancient doors, that the King of glory may come in. Who is he, this King of glory? The Lord Almighty, he's the King of glory. And of course, that was the royal entrance of Jesus into Jerusalem. Was he popular among the people? This time he was, wasn't he? And it's interesting to see the change in the crowd that can be brought about by rabble-rousers. People talk about the fickleness of a crowd of people. But at this point, they were all in his favor. He was very popular. And as he entered Jerusalem, he was welcomed as the king. And there's some of the other things that were said on that occasion are also mentioned in prophecy. And I think I have also here in the handout that I gave you another psalm that mentions part of that scene. Curious story put in here in Mark as you go on reading in the 11th chapter. The next day, as they were leaving Bethany, Jesus was hungry. And so it's thought that the entrance into Jerusalem was on a Sunday. Makes sense that it would be, that it's on the first day of the week. And we want to try to make a timeline out of all this. We'll talk about that in a minute. In a few minutes. The next day, then this is Monday, isn't it? As they were leaving Bethany, Jesus was hungry. Seeing in the distance a fig tree in leaf, he went to find out if it had any fruit. When he reached it, he found nothing but leaves because it was not the season for figs. Then he said to the tree, "May no one ever eat fruit from you again." And his disciples heard him say it. What happened to that tree? It withered up and died from the root up, didn't it? Why did Jesus do that? What's he talking about here? And now, notice how it's linked to what happens when he gets in Jerusalem. Jesus entered the temple area and began driving out those who were buying and selling there. He overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves, and would not allow anyone to carry merchandise through the temple courts. In Daniel chapter 9, verse 27, in the prophecy of the angel to Daniel, talking about his servant, he will confirm a covenant with many for 1 7. A seven there we think is a unit of 7 years. But in the middle of that seven, he will put an end to sacrifice and offering. Is that what Jesus did when he overturned? Overturned the tables of the money changers would not allow anyone to carry merchandise through the temple courts. What happened to the sacrifices? What happened to all of the business that was going on in the temple? It all stopped, didn't it? He stopped it 3.5 years into his ministry, and of course that's as far as his ministry goes. But there's a prophecy in Daniel that probably applies to that. And as he taught them, he said, "Is it not written, my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations? But you've made it a den of robbers." Was the temple for everybody? For all nations? How did the Jews view the temple? It was theirs, wasn't it? Would they let Gentiles in? Well, there was a court of the Gentiles where presumably they could come, but that was the part that was pretty much taken over by all of the merchants, and so it was really a den of robbers. The chief priests and teachers of the law heard this and began looking for a way to kill him, for they feared him because the whole crowd was amazed at his teaching. That's pretty strong words. You've made it a den of robbers. Where does that come from? Isaiah 56 says, "And foreigners who bind themselves to the Lord to serve him." That's Gentiles, you see. He's talking about what God intended for the temple to be. Those who bind themselves to the Lord to serve him and love the name of the Lord, to love the name of the Lord and to worship him, all who keep the Sabbath without desecrating it and who hold fast to my covenant, these will I bring to my holy mountain and give them joy in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and sacrifices will be accepted on my altar. For my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations. And Jesus is referring to that. Remember, we talked about context. This is the passage he's talking about when he's teaching. And so the temple was really intended not to be just for the Jews. It should have included Gentiles as well. They never accepted that concept, did they? And the other part of it, in Jeremiah 7, "Will you steal and murder, commit adultery and perjury, burn incense to Baal and follow other gods you've not known? And then come and stand before me in this house which bears my name." What's the house which bears God's name? It's the temple. "And say, we are safe to do all these detestable things. Has this house which bears my name become a den of robbers to you? But I have been watching, declares the Lord." And so he knows that, of course, was before the destruction of Solomon's temple at the time of Babylonian captivity. But it was apparently true again. It had become a den of robbers. And Jesus clearly expressed that. Now we're going to talk about something that comes up in the next few sections. I want to talk to you a little bit about the new moon. Jonathan said to David, "Tomorrow is the new moon festival. You'll be missed because your seat will be empty." Anybody remember when that happened? Jonathan and David are conferring about trying to determine whether or not King Saul wants to kill David. And so they make a plan. And at that dinner, David tells Jonathan he's not going to be there because he's afraid Saul will kill him. And so you'll be missed. This new moon festival, that was the festival they were holding, a special dinner, because it was the time of the new moon. And so they made a plan, you might recall, that Jonathan would go out in the field and shoot arrows to indicate to David whether his life was in danger or not. So that's in 1 Samuel 20. This new moon festival is mentioned a dozen times in the Old Testament in a variety of places. If you look it up in your concordance, you'll see it mentioned again and again. Every month they held a dinner, a little festival, when they saw a new moon. Why was that important to them? Well, the Jewish calendar was based on lunar months. And so I've written a little paragraph here. The sighting of a new moon determined the first day of the month. And we just passed the first day of the month. Did any of you see the new moon through the clouds? No, I don't imagine you could see it. It's on your calendars, though. And we note those things because a lot of people in the world still pay attention to the cycles of the moon. The new moon would normally be seen as a thin crescent at sunset 1 or 2 days after the conjunction of the moon and the sun. So let's think a minute about our astronomy. The moon is in an orbit around the earth going east, but the earth is turning so that the things in the sky set in the west. Don't be confused by that. The moon makes some progress around the earth every day, and it takes it a little over 24 days. That would be an hour's worth of motion up in the sky. It's an hour earlier up in the sky. It's a little more than that because it takes more than 24 days for it to go around the earth. It actually takes 29 and about a half a day to go all the way around the earth and come back to the sun. And so when it passes the sun, we call that a conjunction, and you can't see the moon when it's near the sun. Certainly can't see it in the sky when it's near the sun. The only time the moon is visible just before or just after the sun goes down or the sun rises, you can see a moon that's about to go by the sun. So you can't see it in the daytime, but you can see it at sunset or sunrise. Now, the new moon would normally be seen as a thin crescent at sunset 1 or 2 days after the conjunction of the moon with the sun. A new moon festival was then held each month. This resulted in 12 months of about 29 or 30 days and a year of only about 355 days. How long is a solar year? Well, it's 364 and a quarter days, isn't it? Since the solar year is 364 and a quarter days, the new year would creep into winter. Their year was too short. And so pretty soon you were trying to plant your seed in the snow, and so that didn't work too well. And spring planting crops would be too early. The solution was to add a 13th month. The whole world did this. They would wait until it got to be too early in the spring. Spring would move into winter, and then they'd add a 13th month. They would simply repeat the 12th month and go and to move spring down to where it ought to be again. And so that's a rather crude solution to the problem, doesn't it? But it worked well for the whole world until clocks and telescopes were invented. Do you realize that? In the last 1,000 years or so, up until then, the year was determined by months, which were determined by the moon. And so that's the calendar that they were working on in New Testament times. The Arabs they still use the lunar month. Did any of you notice that the Arab festival, the Islamic festival of Ramadan, is based upon new moons, and they just let it cycle around to all of the seasons. Every 12 lunar months, they have this 1 month of the feast they call and the fasting that they call Ramadan. And the Chinese New Year began just recently with this new moon. I don't know if you follow that. What year is it? It's the year of the... Anybody remember? What? The ox, that's right. And they go by a zodiac, which includes different kinds of animals. And so they are working on a lunar year just out of tradition, although we know exactly how long it takes. So that's going to play in the story that we're going to look at about the Passover. The modern Jewish calendar now begins in September instead of March. And that's in conjunction with Rosh Hashanah, the festival that they hold in the fall. And so Passover is still in the spring. And as you read on the back side of your handout about Passover, you'll find mention of the month Abib, or Abib. That was the, of ancient times, that was the first month of the year. They started their year in the spring. We start our year in midwinter. But I guess you can start at any time your culture decides. But the Passover is still in the spring. The name of the month, Abib, was changed to Nisan. I don't know any of you who drive a Nissan, which begins with the first new moon after the vernal equinox. And when's the vernal equinox? These are all technical terms. Springtime begins when the days and nights are the same length, and that's March 21st usually. And so the first new moon afterwards decides when Passover is going to be. And so they start counting when they see a new moon. Now the ancients didn't have any particular technology to do this. They just depended upon going out and sighting it. And so it's what it looks like when you have a new moon. This is one day past conjunction, and the moon is illuminated 2% of what it is at full moon, when it's a full moon, the area that's showing. And it's difficult to see. I have, here in the Woodlands, I've gone out several months in a row looking for the new moon one day after conjunction. You find out when it's supposed to be by looking at your calendar. And then you go out and you look at sunset. Well, we have some problems here. Why? Trees. And we also have problems living as close as we do to Houston because of pollution in the air. And often, like it is today, the sky is cloudy. And so there are a number of reasons why you may not see the new moon on the first day after conjunction. Well, what did the Jews do about that? Well, they just went back home and come back the next day and look for it then. And whenever they see a new moon, now the next day the crescent is just a little brighter than it is as you see it here. This one was photographed on the edge of a desert in eastern Turkey. But around here, it's very difficult to see it when it's a new moon, and you might not see it until the second or even the third day after conjunction. Well, they didn't care because the month started. You see, when the month began was ambiguous anyway because it might be the year in which they had a 13th month. They don't care particularly when the first day of the month is because they're counting, how about the Sabbath? The Sabbath is a consecutive mechanism in which you count 7 days and then you get another Sabbath. And so the Sabbath day, the seventh day, isn't affected by this at all. See? So now this is the mechanism that we're working with, and I want you to think about that as we get into the story about the Passover. That's what comes up next in the story. So here we have Jesus cleanse the temple. And incidentally, why did he do the little thing with the fig tree? The fig tree didn't, he could probably be pretty certain that the fig tree didn't have any fruit on it. Now his explanation, if you go back and read that, is he talks about the importance of faith, that he could say to the fig tree, you're dead, and the fig tree would wither, which it did. But that's symbolic of something. What does the fig tree represent here? He doesn't explain it.
An unfruitful life.
An unfruitful life and an unfruitful nation, an unfruitful hierarchy in the temple. All of those things are symbolic in this situation. Symbolized by the fig tree, if they don't bear fruit. And remember, we talked about this last winter, this one of these final parables that Jesus told them about the landowner who rented out his property to the tenants, tenant farmers, who refused to give him any fruit. What did he do? Even his enemies recognized in that story that if you don't pay the landowner his due, They should be dispossessed and the property given to somebody else who will yield fruit to the owner in its proper season. So that's the problem, isn't it? And it's an interesting symbol that he gives there. Now I want you to think as we study, read the material here about the Passover in Exodus. And incidentally, there's another passage that goes with this. If you keep reading in the 12th chapter of Exodus, you'll see that there's a series of days, 7 days, in which they are to eat unleavened bread, and it starts with the day of the Passover, and that day is a holy day. That day is considered by the Jews to be a special Sabbath, and so we'll keep that in mind as we talk about it too. Now, what I want you to do as we look at this material is to see if you can establish a timeline for this last week of Jesus' life. There's all sorts of confusion in the if you read the different commentaries about this for an interesting reason. But here we see the first 3 days. The Saturday he was in Bethany, the Friday before we don't think that's when that dinner was held. Both Matthew and Mark say it was held 2 days before the Passover. And so I don't think John intended for you to draw that conclusion. But anyway, Saturday he was in Bethany. Sunday he enters Jerusalem. Monday is the cleansing of the temple, and then they go home, go back to Bethany. That's where home is at this time. Now what happens on Tuesday? What happens on Wednesday? What happens on Thursday? As you read, make a little diagram on your paper there somewhere and see if you can figure out what to write in those various time slots. I think we can do that, and I think it's an interesting exercise to get a very clear picture. The surprises are, and I'll give you the punchline, Jesus was not crucified on Good Friday. Okay? We can take that home with us now. That doesn't make any sense at all, and for several very good reasons. It wasn't on Friday that he was crucified. He was crucified on Thursday. Had to be if he was 3 days in the grave and raised on Sunday. There's absolutely no question about the fact that he was resurrected on Sunday morning. So do that. That's kind of an interesting way to put your information in sequence here and see if we can sort of summarize what happens from day to day as we go through this story now, through the critical period of the Last Supper and the celebration of Passover, and the arrest, the trial, the crucifixion, the burial, and the resurrection. Those are the key elements that we're going to look at over the next few weeks. Okay, our time is gone this morning. Any questions or comments anybody wants to make about any of this? It's the central story of the Gospels. The Gospels take about a third of their total space describing what happens in these few days. And so we need to look at it very, very carefully. Thank you very much.